Well, actually, I'm going to speak about a part of discerning God's will, which is the discernment of spirits. Discerning God's will is a little bigger, more encompassing thing, but discerning spirits. I don't know, how many of you are familiar with Father Tim Gallagher? You already know. Have you read his book, Discernment of Spirits? How many? Okay, well,
Well,
okay, before I get to that, though, I don't know if I've ever kind of introduced it like this before, but this is how I'm going to start. Kind of in analyzing ourselves and analyzing, you know, this leading the examined life, there's kind of six categories, so to speak, I'll mention. The first obvious level is of something that influences us is the physical level. I remember once this young lady came to me and she was an old friend, you know, and she came to me for some spiritual direction. I haven't said this much in my life, but I said to her, when is the last time you had a general physical, you know, examination? And later she says, gosh, I came to you in spiritual direction, you asked me, okay. Well, it just struck me that maybe, you know, her sleep problem or whatever it was, you know, she should start there, you know. It's kind of the Jesuit influence. You start from first base and see if that, before you go to second base, you know. Then, of course, there's the psychological level. And for that, I don't get beyond, and the kind of psychology that I use is called cognitive psychology. I baptize this, cognitive psychology. And it's very simple. It's just, you know, we have certain bad habits of thought that cause bad emotions. You recognize those bad habits of thought, you turn them around and make them good habits. Right? It's very simple. Doesn't talk about subconscious or anything like that. It's just very simple. And again, I baptize, I give it Christian content. You know, I have this one friend, Paul Vitz. I don't know if you ever heard of him, Dr. Paul Vitz. He's a very old friend of mine. And he and some friends actually started, I don't know if it still exists, the St. Michael's Institute in New York City. And if a person comes with problems, there's three persons they have to see. First, they have to see a physician to see if there's some kind of physical base to their problem. Then they go see a psychiatrist or psychologist, you know, all very good Catholics, to see if that's part of the problem. And then they go see a spiritual director to see if that's part of the problem. And then these three people meet, and they kind of decide what's what, right? Because, as I said, you don't put a spiritual band-aid on a psychological wound, right? And you don't put a psychological band-aid on a spiritual wound. You know, you kind of have to discern those. So there's the physical, the psychological. There's the moral level that affects us. Bishop Sheen wrote that famous book, Peace of Soul. And he says a lot of disorders could be resolved because the root is unresolved guilt. You know, you get that out of there, and then these effects in your psyche can be taken care of. That's why Bishop Sheen, actually, towards the end of his life, he talked about the priest psychologist as the priest of the future, the priest who would have the sacramental power to take out the root of guilt, and then also he would know how to correct those manifestations that kind of reverberated from that. I should, just not to be so formal, I should tell you, you know, I'm a convert, and when I wanted to convert, somebody told me about this bishop, this famous bishop, and I didn't know who he was, you know. So I got his address out of Who's Who, and wrote him, and I said I wanted to become a Catholic, a priest, and a hermit monk. It was Bishop Sheen, and he had me come out to New York, you know, and then he helped me into the church. But, yeah, I didn't even know who he was. It was kind of funny. That's when I was going to Grand Valley. And after I found out who he was, I was walking down the street in Grand Rapids in a place I'd never been before. And just thinking, who are you, this nobody, to go see this, you know, famous man? And I looked, and I was standing on the corner. You know how street signs are like that? And I was standing on the corner of Fulton and Dennis Street.
Oh, oh, that's very funny.
Isn't that funny?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, God gives me a sign, it has to be a real sign or I don't get it. One of Benedict Groeschel's men said, I bet Dennis is a very small street in Fulton. And it is, Dennis is like two blocks, and Fulton is this big one.
Appropriately.
But anyway, back to the subject here. So he wrote a book, again, on that the moral root can affect us also, obviously. You know, all these things I'm saying are kind of obvious, but I'm leading up to something here. And then, of course, there's the social things that affect us, you know, all of our interpersonal relations, both with the invisible and the visible, you know, our culture. Again, if any of you can read the, perhaps after George Weigel, who's a layman, the greatest Catholic thinker in the United States, Cardinal George of Chicago wrote these two books, The Difference God Makes in God, and he talks about how the culture influences us, you know, and just, you know, there's no way to say that you are not American when you're in America, because you are, and therefore you have to know what that is, you know, in order to evangelize it. So the culture affects us, both positively and negatively. in our interpersonal relationships, the environment helps us. I knew this one girl, she had OCD, she wasn't a Carmelite. Obsessive compulsive disorder. And when the weather starts to change like this, you know, it kind of affects her very, she goes into real, you know, nosedives. So, you know, all of these things can affect us. But the most important level, obviously, is the spiritual level. And that's what I'm going to talk about, the discernment of spirits. If you know this already, well, you're going to hear it again from a certain respect. I'm going to go through St. Ignatius's rules for the discernment of spirits briefly, but first I want to read one of my favorite number maybe in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, 409. I remember that because it was a famous Chevrolet when I was a kid. And the lady who's the head of my lay group said she remembers because of some kind of cleaner or something like that. But this is the case. This is a dramatic statement. And it quotes the Second Vatican Council. He says, "This dramatic situation of the whole world, which is in the power of the evil one, makes man's life a battle." And then quoting the council. "The whole of man's history has been the story of the dour combat with the powers of evil. Stretching, so our Lord tells us, from the very dawn of history until the last day. Finding himself in the midst of the battlefield, man has to struggle to do what is right. And it is at great cost to himself, and aided by God's grace, that he succeeds in achieving his own inner integrity." I always say, amen, when I read that. It is at great cost to himself, and aided by God's grace, the man succeeds in achieving his inner integrity. Now, in order to act effectively within, I mean, life is war. That's what it is. And if you don't recognize that, you know, if you don't recognize that there are these invisible influences on us every day, both good and bad, you know, I kind of half-jokingly sometimes say, you know, psychologists say if you're not in the definition of insanity is you're not in contact with reality. Therefore, most people, I think, are insane. But half-joking, okay. Because this is the reality. We have every moment of the day, we have invisible influences on us. If we don't recognize that, then we're bounced around, you know, indiscriminately. And if we don't examine, we don't think, then, you know, like I was for many years, it's just, you know, all over the place, and you don't know where it's coming from. You think it's coming from yourself, but a lot of times it's not. A lot of times it is. So, St. Ignatius has two sets of the rules for the discernment of spirits. For you who already know that, this will be an Ignatian repetition. Ignatius has a certain type of prayer, and if something strikes you, then, like, that's what I do. I give the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. And if something, like, strikes you in the nativity when you're contemplating that, then you'll keep doing that. You know, like, if you're doing a 30-day retreat, you do 5 hours every day. You won't go on to the visitation. You know, you'll stay with that as long as you keep unpacking it. because the repetition means it keeps going deeper and deeper. I've gotten so radically into this that, like, sometimes if something strikes me, like in my yearly retreat, I'll spend a long time, I think, if something struck me deeply in Jesus sleeping in the boat, and I spent 6 months on it every day, meditating on it, just unpacking it, you know, letting it become more a part of myself. And once you get into this, it is a prayer of simplicity, kind of, but it just becomes more a part of you. So that's an exhortation to you not to think that you're going through this uselessly again. So St. Ignatius has two sets of the rules for the discernment of spirits. It's 9 pages, and these 9 pages is just a treasure house, an indescribable treasure house of the ability to, well, I don't know, fight effectively. The first set of rules are when God gives consolations and positive helps to help you grow. The devil tries to obstacle that by causing counter movements. The second set of the rules are when the devil counterfeits God. And, you know, he tries to get you to do good things, but not the good things you're supposed to be doing. Now, I didn't know how many people had noticed, so I just prepared to kind of go through the rules, just briefly commenting on them. You know, in the first set of rules, he says, it is characteristic of the evil spirit to harass with anxiety, to afflict with sadness, to raise obstacles backed by fallacious reasonings that disturb the soul. Thus he seeks to prevent the soul from advancing. St. Ignatius doesn't say to get him to sin. You know, Satan wants to prevent us from advancing. In fact, I am convinced that he prefers to destroy our peace of soul, even to getting us to sin. I call it the 1-2 punch in boxing. You'll forgive me for that. But, you know, it's like sin, sometimes he kind of hits us and gets us off balance, but he wants the knockout, which is to destroy our peace. Peace is the most important. If any of you read that Jacques Philippe, he's very popular. That book on peace is really wonderful. In fact, he has a great quotation which ends it from Padre Pio, feast day tomorrow. And Padre Pio, he just goes to this whole thing about even when you sin, and Lanteri, our founder, also just, don't do anything to lose your peace, even when you sin. Even if you mortally sin, you don't let the next step come and you lose your peace, because it's non-productive, it's counterproductive. Our founder, as you know, Anne, gave us as our motto of the Oblates of the Virgin Mary, Nunc Chepi, now I begin. And he was radical in this. He said, if I fall 1,000 times, 1,000 times I will get up and say, now I begin. Absolute confidence in God's mercy. He said, if I fall 1,000 times a day, 1,000 times I will get up and say, now I begin. This, you know, absolute trust in God's mercy. I did what I am, now you do what you are. You know, and just, because again, this is part of the subtlety. Always he's moving us to this lack of peace, this disturbance, this disturbances of soul. Doesn't he all the time? He harasses me all day, every day. And he wins some of the time and sometimes he loses. But, you know, but it's, anyway. It is characteristic of the good spirit, however, to give courage, strength, consolation, tears, inspiration, and peace. Then he goes through and explains, I don't know if we should go through the whole, what consolation and desolation is. You know, consolation is more or less what he just said, and desolation is the opposite. Now, one of the rules, very important, in time of desolation, when you're feeling, you know, Bishop Sheen used to talk about white grace and black grace. White grace is when you feel the presence of God. Black grace is when he is permitting you not to feel his presence for a certain reason, you know, so you feel the absence of God. And God bless you. And St. Ignatius says, when you feel this tug towards earthly and, you know, well, let me see, desolation. I call desolation what is entirely an inclination, darkness of soul, turmoil of spirit, inclination to what is low and earthly, restlessness rising from many disturbances and temptations, to which leads to want of faith, want of hope, one of love. The soul is wholly slothful, tepid, sad, and separated, as it were, from its creator and Lord. You know, and this, the thoughts that come from desolation are always from the evil one and from our own deficient inclinations. And the thoughts that come from a consolation always from God. Now, he says, in a desolation, you never, ever, 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 ever make a change. I have blown things, believe me, by making a change. I've blown big things. Big things. People have changed their whole life. If they would have just, what, waited it out. In fact, that's the next. Oh, no, actually, it's not the next. Okay, the next one is, again, he says, because in a desolation, only the evil spirit. So, when you do feel this kind of absence and tugging and lowness and anxiety and, you know, that desolation, the devil will suggest you make a change in your spiritual life, in your vocational life, whatever. I wonder how many divorces, I wonder how many people leave consecrated life, you know, because they didn't, because they thought it was coming from themselves, kind of. You know, they didn't realize that it was coming. You know, actually, I had that experience before my final vows. It just came to my mind. I almost got up and walked out. That's the truth. In the ceremony. I was utterly leaned upon. Now, just think, if I would have acted upon that, my whole life would have changed, right? You don't get up and walk out of a ceremony of final vows and come back. You know, they would get out of here. You know. But the devil just was enormously leaned on me, as enormously as you could possibly imagine. Well, like St. Therese of the Child Jesus, right? Desperately wanting to be a Carmelite the night before final vows, you know, I'm not called. And her novice messages laughed at her, you know, and then it went away. So you never make a change. But, he said, you should intensify your activity against the desolation. It's not just mere passivity, not just merely suffering it out. And St. Ignatius gives a few things, you know, prayer, meditation, examination, you know, see if there's a non-spiritual root, as Gallagher says, you know, something I did wrong or something, you know, that I can trace back, that the devil picked up the ball and ran with it, so to speak. For my money on that, mine is always, you know, this thing of John Paul II, we're all unique and unrepeatable individuals, so you find what works for you. And it again, leading, you know, you kind of find things that aren't counterproductive or waste of time. You know, I kind of had to get a little more sophisticated on that, you know, like in a desolation, you know, not to go to YouTube and, you know, watch people scaring other people with train horns or something. You know. Sorry to admit that. It's very funny. But, you know, it doesn't help. It didn't help the desolation. It temporarily put it on pause, but then you went right back into it. So you find out from experiment, you know, what works for you to actually counter the desolation effect. And there's whole chapters on this, you know, Gallagher's book, Discernment of Spirits. If you can read it, please read it. Again, when one is in desolation, you should remember that God has not deserted you. That thing, the Holy Father is giving some amazing, amazing audiences now in his Wednesday audience. And he did one on Psalm 3. I've been meditating on it for 2 weeks now. I have the English translation, but I'm going to take it from the Italian because I like the Italian a little better. I'm not going to do the Italian, but I'm going to translate it. But in this Psalm 3, it's so awesome. You go to Zenit, they have the whole translation, and on the Wednesday audience on Psalm 3. And he said, you know, O Lord, how many are my adversaries? Many are rise up against me. Many are saying of my life, for him there's no salvation in God. And he talks about this repetition of many, many, many. He says the fear, ingantisce, makes giant, you know, what the dangers that are already there. It magnifies it, the fear. And he says, but the prayer doesn't not let this conquer him, but maintains this solid relationship with God, in whom he's seeking his help. But the enemies try even to break this link with God and destroy his faith of the victim. They insinuate that the Lord cannot intervene. They affirm that not even God can save him. You know, there are those moments when we think, you know, is God, you know, coming? The aggression, therefore, he says, is not only physical, but touches the spiritual, the dimension. The Lord is not able to save you, they say. The central nucleus of the soul of the psalmist is aggressed against. It's the extreme temptation to which the believer undergoes. It's the temptation to lose faith, confidence in the nearness of God. To lose faith, confidence. Even if you don't feel it, you can still have faith in it. He says the just man overcomes this ultimate test and remains solid in the faith, in the certainty of the truth, and in the full confidence in God. He says, it seems to me that this psalm touches each one of us very personally. In many problems, we're tempted to think maybe that God can't save him. Maybe he doesn't know. He's too distant. You know, whether we say that to ourselves or not, that's the feeling, no? He doesn't know me. Fourth, maybe there's not a possibility here. The temptation against this faith is the ultimate aggression of the enemy. And this, we are to resist and therefore respond. He says this certainty of the presence of God. This is what St. Ignatius is saying in that rule. He says, although you don't feel God's presence, don't forget he is there. He's very near in these severe kind of temptations. And you can resist with the help of God, which always remains, though you may not really perceive it. Okay, the next one, when one is in desolation, you are to persevere in patience. Okay, that's kind of obvious, isn't it? You ride out the storm rather than letting it take you down too deeply or going to other things that are even harmful. You know, as Father Tim, I heard him give a talk to the seminarians there, and he said, you know, rather than, you know, the opening up that site on the internet or whatever, you know, that's temptation to things that are falsely presented to give you kind of a countering consolation and everything. Persevere in patience. Okay, he says there are three reasons why God permits this. He doesn't cause desolation, right? He permits it. The first, he says, is a wake-up call. Sometimes we do become a little relaxed unnecessarily in our spiritual life. There are ups and downs, right? And he lets you experience this to kind of say, you know, get back on track here a little bit. You know, you're getting a little, you know, like lazy or whatever, right? That you're not doing what is good for you. That's the first reason. The second reason is for maturity, to give us an opportunity to be mature. And Gallagher makes the distinction between like a patriot fighting for his country and a mercenary. A mercenary is a soldier who's not part of that country but is paid for it. Says when the money runs out, the mercenary will stop fighting and go away. The patriot will keep fighting because he's committed interiorly, right? So he gives us a chance to prove that we're not mercenaries and we're not doing it for, he's giving us a chance not to get all the cookies and candy and ice cream. And there's a profound lesson here. I was preparing a homily for this Sunday, which I found out I didn't have to give. Because there's a mission preacher. But it was good for me. Because I looked through this book of Mother Teresa again, on Mother Teresa, that Come Be My Light. Mm-hmm. And I actually gave the Missionaries of Charity in Amman, Jordan, a retreat based in that book. It's very interesting. You know, they're very heroic in that part of the world. You know, they face death daily. You know, there's been a number of martyrs. I don't know yet. I don't know if you know that. This one nun I talked to, she had been in Sierra Leone, when the rebels took over, and they took these four missionaries of charity, tortured them throughout the mountains, shot them one at a time, shot the sister next to her. And then they shot her, but then one of the rebels said, no, wait, she's from my village, she takes care of our poor, take her down to the hospital. And she kind of emptied herself to me for hours. She remembered everything in detail, right? And in Yemen, somebody came in and shot three of them in the head, you know, and they have all these martyrs. But, so, you know, like giving a retreat to them was like, wow. Yeah. You know, giving it to spiritual giants, right? The ones from Gaza, they face death every day, you know. But they're so totally cheerful. They're totally happy and cheerful. It's kind of interesting. But in this book, I don't know if you've read it much, Come Be My Light.
Yes.
That's a challenge, isn't it? That's a challenge. You know, I could give now several hours of talk on that book. But let's see what else. Oh, yeah. Obviously, Mother Teresa, 40 years, experienced an interior spiritual darkness. Uniting herself, of course, to the kenosis of Jesus Christ, the self-emptying. In fact, she kept saying that throughout the books. She keeps saying, Jesus has to keep emptying me of every last drop of myself. And after being emptied so much, then he can fill himself, me up with him. So that's one of the reasons that God permits it too. This continual kenosis, you know. Kenosis means he emptied himself, right? Philippians 3. He emptied himself and took the form of a slave. You know, we, in the first sin, we wanted to fill ourselves up and be infinitely equal to God, right? What did God do? The opposite. He emptied himself. And I would love to launch into that homily, but I won't. And so it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to grow in that real, redemptive, spiritual maturity without being paid. The candy and cookies. The third reason is because of humility. You know, even, you know, when we do get spiritual gifts a lot of times, and if we did, and to the extent we did, and even if we're humble, there's always kind of maybe a subtle voice back there, you know, just, I'm different and special, you know. So God helps us, you know, to keep that emptied. By the opportunities to experience these desolations. Well, I remember Father Chizik looked at me once and he said, you know, Dennis, he says, consolations are good, but desolations are better. And I went, how can you say that? Consolations are from God and desolations are from the devil. I don't know if you know Father Chizik, who he is. He was my spiritual director. He was 5 years tortured in Moscow and Lubyanka in the secret services of the Russians, the worst prison in 15 years in Siberian prison camps. So he learned this lesson, you know. He learned this lesson very well of humility. Of course, he said he needed all that just to learn that. Hopefully, we'll need a little less. But in any event, you know, it's funny, right after he died, I got another spiritual director, this Hungarian Jesuit who had been in China when Mao took over, and they kept him in a little cage for years, you know. And I looked up at our lawyer, I said, do you have something in mind for me? You know. Now this next, something that fairly few people do, but if you did, you'd have it sewn up. He said, when you're in a consolation, prepare for the next desolation. Learn what didn't work before when you're all feeling strong and everything. And when that comes again, be prepared to do the things you want to do rather than things you might have done before which were counterproductive. And then here is the one that in this company is always a little difficult. He says the enemy conducts himself as a woman. So, and you always have to backtrack and backpedal and all that stuff and explain. But just the context, the Spanish women, nobility, among whom he moved in those days, were very well known for their kind of imperiousness and vindictiveness, especially towards their servants. They were very, Spanish women are still a little like that, the ones from Spain. some of them, the high class kind of aristocratic ones. You don't cross them, otherwise, hell hath no fury. But in any event, but in this rule, he says, we should never be frightened of the devil. We should never be frightened. Ever. Because if you're ever frightened, he's convinced you already that he is more than he is. He's not. As our founder said, he can bark, but he can't bite. Mm-hmm. He will bark a lot, but he can't bite. You know, I have contempt for him. You know, I express my contempt a lot. He said, if you begin to be afraid, no wild animal on the earth will be more pursuant. I don't know what he's saying. However, if one begins to be afraid and lose courage, no wild animal on earth can be more fierce than the enemy of our human nature. He will carry out his perverse intentions with consummate malice. So, again, should we have fear? Yeah, that kind of fear that causes caution, but not the fright. Not fright. Because then, you know, in fact, one old spiritual director of mine, an old Italian, said, humiliate him. He hates humiliation, you know. So I've been using unpriestly language a little while, but it's something. Okay, he then says the enemy be compared to a man who's trying, somebody who's trying to seduce somebody else. They'll say somebody's trying to seduce somebody's daughter or wife. He said he doesn't want that exposed, because once he's exposed, then his game's up. So he said, you know, when the devil's trying to, you know, get you to do things, find a trusted spiritual person and reveal it to them. And I've had this happen before. Sometimes, not even a spiritual director, you know, I'll be like having this obsessive thought or something or fear, and I'll mention it to the person, and they'll say something like, you know, it's ridiculous, and it'll evaporate. So to get it out, not to keep it in there, you know. But to a trusted person. To a trusted person who you know who's sane and good and is not going to say something stupid and make it worse. Simply speaking. So, the last rule of these first set, extremely important, and I could give big homilies on this, 2.5. And St. Ignatius was a soldier, so he used these military analogies. He said the enemy is like a clever enemy commander. You know, these walled cities, they still have them in Europe. And they're great. They have the medieval cities, Lucca in North Italy. It's just round. He says he will go around when they're attacking a city and see where the fortifications are weakest, and there he will try to take it by storm. And he says the devil examines you. He goes all around, sees all of your moral and spiritual and theological virtues and vices, and where he sees you are weakest, there he attacks. And he always continually attacks. Therefore, you shouldn't be surprised if you fall in one thing more than another, you know. In fact, we all have, I'll launch into part of my homily here, we all have what's called a prevalent tendency to one sin or another. And that's actually our field of growing in holiness. You know, our Lord permits that. I've been next to some very holy people, and I've been very surprised. There's a little kind of vice of impatience. You're kind of shocked, you know. Mm-hmm. But you know that God has left it there for their humility, and they've been working against it all their life. You know, but again, you know, God is permitting that. You know what my personal motto is? Saints are sinners who kept trying, okay? Saints are sinners who kept trying. I studied at the Congregation for the Causes of Saints in Rome to become a postulator, perhaps. And, you know, when they're investigating the life of a person whose cause is introduced, if they find a repeated sin, that doesn't stop the process, as long as they find a continual agire contra, acting against. As Father Hardin used to say, some of St. Jerome's letters are untranslatable in polite company. You know, he had a problem with anger, and he expressed himself radically. But he, you know, and you know, some saints, they know this so well, and they reinforce themselves, and they're always working on that one thing so hard that they actually become known for the opposite virtue. St. Francis de Sales, they used to praise for his patience, and he laughed. He'd say, sometimes I have to leave the room and bite my tongue. You know, Father Hardin was known as the Energizer Bunny, you know, of the apostolate. he said his primary tendency was towards sloth, towards laziness. But he burnt everybody out around him, you know, from his, because why? Because he was continually, he knew this, that it was a prevalent tendency, he knew the devil was always tempting him to that, so he always was working it. So that, no shaiti ipsums, no, know yourself, Socrates' famous thing. Obviously, no, but it's good to hear it repeated. The second set of the rules for the discernment of spirits, and again, you know, you could, I had them print these out. I actually am giving seminars on the discernment of spirits from October through June, and if anybody wants to take part, we meet monthly. Beginning at Old St. Patrick's Church, I'm not sure if we're going to stay there, but we go through Father Gallagher's first book for about 5 months on the discernment of spirits. And then we go through the Examine Prayer book, where you actually make this a state of consciousness, a habit, a virtue, so that you don't have to think about it so much. You actually have a certain ways that you can make this so it's just a state of consciousness. You're always discerning. And it's not difficult. It's not a hard thing, you know, like any virtue. And then we go into the spiritual consolation, which is his commentary on the second set of the rules for the discernment of spirits, when the devil appears as an angel of light. Now, Father Gallagher does not like to present this to a lot of people. We've had discussions on this. We have different outlooks. I present it just about to everybody, especially, you know, people who are serious in the spiritual life, because it's, you know, it's a big thing. It's a big kind of danger all the time. The devil will appear as an angel of light. And this is what he says. He says, "It is the mark of the angel to assume the appearance of an angel of light. He begins by suggesting thoughts that are suited to a devout soul and ends by suggesting his own. For example, he will suggest holy and pious thoughts that are wholly in conformity with the sanctity of his soul. Afterwards, he will endeavor little by little to end by drawing the soul into his hidden snares and evil designs." So, how do we know? You know, the devil is the great counterfeiter. This, you know, in the first rules, God gave consolation, the devil gives desolation. The second set, God gives consolation, the devil gives consolation, okay? But he's counterfeiting. How do you know? Because it starts out good, but ends bad, okay? It starts out like this. He said, and so, what do you do? And again, you know, Gallagher goes into this, some examples, some kind of dramatic examples in this book. The Curé of Ars, St. Jean-Baptiste Marie de Vianney, consistently tempted to become a Carthusian because he didn't think he was a good confessor. You gotta love a guy like that. But, you know, so he was on his way to the Carthusians a lot of times because he felt this kind of consolation and kind of like these irritations also, but it was a counter. The devil has really deceived me sometimes in several big ways in this, that I thought that I was doing something good, but it was real deception. I found out eventually. And how? So, and actually that's what happens to us a lot of times. And God permits it, and everything's in his plan. You know, you don't have to worry about this. Oh, wait, a little bit. But but he says, once you have been tricked, he says we must carefully observe the whole course of our thoughts. If the beginning and middle and end of the course of the thoughts are wholly good and directed to what is entirely right, it is a sign they are from the good angel. But the course of thought suggested to us may terminate in something evil or distracting or less good than the soul had formerly proposed to do. Again, it may end in what weakens the soul or disquiets it, or by destroying the peace, tranquility, and quiet which it had before. These things are a clear sign that the thoughts are proceeding from the evil spirit, the enemy of our progress and eternal salvation. In fact, St. Ignatius himself had a mystical vision in front of himself, some green thing that gave him great consolation for weeks. But finally, he saw it was taking him away from all his spiritual duties. Okay, it's not from God. Go away. It was gone. So, you know, but most of us don't, you know, have visions like that. I don't. at all. I remember in the beginning of my spiritual life, I really wanted to be a mystic, right? I think you heard about that, you know. I fasted on bread and water, you know, for a year, you know, and didn't sleep and everything, and I got nothing. Okay. I got sick. So, but God actually gave me His safer way, you know, because if you get into mystical visions and everything at St. John of the Cross is, you know, reject them, even if they're from God, he says, because the devil is such a good counterfeiter. He says, if they're from God, they'll get through, don't worry. But he's such a good counterfeiter, you know, so, you know, but that's on another level. Maybe it's not on another level for some of you. Maybe you have visions, I don't know. But, so what we do is learn from experience. That's the big thing. That's what the discernment of spirits, the art and virtue is learning from experience. Sometimes it takes a lot of experiences until we finally learn. I've been, you know, tricked so many times in one thing by the devil until I finally learned. Sometimes after 20 years, you know, I keep thinking, oh, geez, he did it again. And then finally it kicks in. Finally I start to counter it. Effectively, maybe I take a little time, but you know, maybe most people don't have to take that much time. But so we learn from experience. That's the big thing here. Just one more I'll comment on. This one I didn't think, for years I just thought, well, yeah, obvious. You know, he says, and he uses an analogy. He said, you know, he says, when the spirits are like each other, it's like a drop of water on a sponge. When the spirits are unlike each other, it's like a drop of water on a rock, causing noise and distraction, you know, and everything like that. If it's from God, it always comes with peace and strength. You know, and let me give you an example. Something I've succeeded at, something I've blown and learned from experience. Let's say that I sometimes we are obliged to do a fraternal correction, morally obliged. So, and sometimes I've done it like this. Oh, I have to do it now. I have to do it now. No? No, wait a second, you know. Now I say, wait a second. I didn't before. Then I go and do it, you know, because the devil gets us to try to do the right thing, but at the wrong time, from the wrong motive, in the wrong manner, in the wrong circumstances. You know, if it comes in this, that's not from God. Even if it's the right thing and the good thing that you're supposed to be doing, you wait until that passes, until you have the right inner graces to do it with. You know, and so, you know, and I learned that through sad, well, you know, at least painful experience of just, you know, and he tricks me every once in a while still, you know, but I have content. I just, good one. Yeah. And then I get up, noon chapey, right? Now I begin. So, good. That was just kind of a simple review of things that I actually, you know, if you read the books or attend the seminar, then you can go more extensively into. Because discernment of spirits, let's say, is four things. Well, five things. It's a grace you have to pray for every day. I pray for it every day. The Catechism says we pray for that when we say, lead us not into temptation. In the Our Father. We're actually asking for the discernment of spirits, among other things. It's a science you can learn. That's the books, right? You can get this knowledge. And it's a grace. Knowledge, but with all grace and knowledge, it really doesn't become part of you until you start to put it into practice in your life, and then it becomes a skill, an art, and then what becomes habitual becomes a virtue. Some people have the charism, St. Paul lists the charismatic gifts, and one of those is these are extraordinarily. I don't know if I have that charism. Perhaps I do. But mostly I'm struggling on elementary levels. You know, if people get to kind of higher, I send them to somebody else. But it's my own kenosis, my own self-emptying. So it's on all those levels. Again, so, you know, we pray for the grace every day. We try to learn from the rules, the commentaries on the rules, and then, but you only learn by experiencing it, and learning through experience, falling, getting up, learning, and then you become a communicator of it, too. And believe me, this is so, it makes a whole change in your whole life when you learn this. When I give people this book and when I've introduced them to it, utter change in their whole life. All of a sudden, consciousness of reality opens up to them. Now, one way, of course, intensive way of entering into the discernment of spirits is taking the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. I'm not sure if you're aware of those. I give those. I was giving them in a retreat house, but the retreat house closed. So now, but I give them in daily life. From January to June, if anybody's interested. I cut it off at 70 people, okay? I give 70 people, and that means I'm in contact with each one of them once a week by email, 14 a day, Monday through Friday, and then once a month face-to-face. And then aside from that hobby, then I do my work. But in any event, that's an intensive prayer experience in the discernment of spirits. That's what that is. And I could give a quote. Of course, that's why I exist, to give those. Let me just synopsize them. If you're not familiar with them, really synopsize them. Let me think how I can do this in 2 minutes. Okay. The exercises, and several of you have taken them with me, so you know, follow a certain dynamic that we find in the Mass, actually. You know, we begin with the penitential rite, right? That prepares us for the liturgy of the Word, where we're illuminated, which prepares us for the liturgy of the Eucharist, where we're united with Christ. So it's that purification, illumination, and union. And that's, St. Ignatius originally envisioned them for 30 days. A person goes away for 30 days and does 5 separate hours every day. They go through this purifying experience, which then plows the ground for the planting of the seed of the Word, and then you do contemplations on the life of Christ from the Incarnation to Palm Sunday, making a movie in your head, entering it, writing what the Holy Spirit tells you, and then with the director, you kind of discern where God is leading and where the evil one is countering, and this all leads into the unitive experience where you try to experience in your heart what Christ was experiencing in his heart, in the Passion and the Resurrection. But it's, again, if you're interested in that, Ann Arbor Retreats at AOL.com. But I cut it off at 70, which is insane anyway. Yeah. I remember years ago I said to Father Tim Gallagher, I'm giving 10 people. He said, maybe you should cut it down a little bit. I don't even talk about him. He just thinks that's outrageous. But in any event, so that's kind of a little kind of introduction to the discernment of spirits. You kind of get a taste of what it is. Any, as a professor of mine always used to end, any questions, comments, or criticisms? Anything? Anything? Any questions?
Well,
yes?
So, on the second set, mm-hmm. you said that, and it was a little abstract, but
okay.
you said that something might start good, but if it's from the devil, it won't end well.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of relates to a larger question I have.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, so I'm not, where I come from, we don't talk about the devil a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
We talk a lot about sin and
mm-hmm.
the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, what about the flesh? And if something started well and ended poorly, how do you know that the flesh didn't just ruin it?
That's a good question. Because there's a certain kind of, almost you might say, feeling with a consolation. You know, and what it leads to, you know, if you start to understand by experience what this feels like to start losing peace. It's not necessarily that it leads you to sin, okay? This, you know, this when the devil counterfeits it, it leads to distraction or something else, and it does that consistently, okay? And as you develop these perceptions, and it's not a science that you can put under a microscope now, right? This is kind of a thing you kind of learn through perceiving this. You do start to learn the distinction. Now, let me use an obvious example. Okay, I knew this one homeschooling mother, and she was spending a lot of time before the Blessed Sacrament, right? She was consoled, but neglecting her children. You know, that's an obvious example, right? But, again, if it's something, if prayer is your virtue, the devil will see that, and he will get you to pray either in such a way or at such times that it's not going to, you'll see that it's not strengthening you, and you'll see that consistently, and you'll start, as the Italians say, you'll start to smell something burning, right? You kind of learn that through experience. So, you would know the difference because this is a spiritual experience. On the other thing, if I've made a resolution, a good resolution, and it ends in the flesh, something that might not be so much a spiritual experience, it's more like a moral experience, and you start to kind of, this sounds kind of abstract, doesn't it? But
uh-huh. And it just occurred to me that, yeah, if it is in the flesh, that's obvious, that's the flesh, that's a different thing, that's not what you're talking about.
Not exactly.
So.
Oh, it could, though, it could. There's not fine distinctions here, because he said it could lead to something like that. But you start to sense, you actually, when you get into this and it becomes a little more familiar to you, you actually start to sense when it's the devil or you, or your flesh, so to speak. On the moral level or the spiritual level, and then you also not only that, but you see where sometimes it's both. You see where one begins and where it ends, or one's like feeding off the other. Like Gallagher talks about spiritual and non-spiritual desolation, spiritual and non-spiritual consolation. I don't like that language as well, but that's what he uses, and he's accurate in what he's talking about. But he's saying I might be getting off the track here, but I'll say it anyway. Like if a person hasn't slept well, right? That's a non-spiritual desolation, right? But the devil can then take that and take it into a spiritual desolation. So, these things, there's not like these nice fine lines, but you kind of learn, you start to learn through the sensitivity that you develop when it's on the moral level, when it's on the spiritual level, and where it intermixes. I wish I could be more clear, but yeah. But that's a profound question. I wouldn't even have to think about that more to answer it accurately. But I, at my age, I don't think on my feet that well anymore. Unless I've had like a triple espresso, then I'm better.
Father, thank you so much.